You know, the way the human spirit can just endure incredible hardship, and not just endure, but actually reshape itself afterwards. It's really something.
It absolutely is. That kind of resilience is, well, it's profound.
And that's exactly what we're diving into today. We're looking at the story of Chris Morgan. He was a World War II fighter pilot, went from, you know, wanting to be a hero to becoming a prisoner of war.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also about what happened after that, this unexpected force that really guided his life.
Right. And our source here is fantastic. It's firsthand. Episode 23, The Wind Beneath Your Wings, OGTA, #8 from the Military Tales YouTube channel. It's Chris himself telling his story.
Yeah, hearing it directly from him adds so much weight. So we'll trace his life like he lays it out. That childhood fascination with planes, the path to becoming a pilot, then that fateful first mission.
His time as a POW, which sounds harrowing, and then his life after the war, especially this key relationship he mentions.
Exactly. So let's call it our mission for this deep dive is to really understand those pivotal moments, the sort of internal shifts for Chris Morgan. What can we learn about resilience, the will to live, and maybe the power of human connection?
Sounds good. Where do we start? His childhood.
Let's do that. He grew up in Whitestone, Queens, New York. Pretty ordinary background, right?
Yeah.
Father a policeman, mother a seamstress.
Yeah, a very sort of grounded start. But then you have this early fascination with flying, places like Floyd Bennett Field, Mitchell Field.
He talks about seeing military planes flying in formation, remembers this unbelievable drone. You can just picture a kid looking up, totally captivated.
Absolutely. That visual, that sound, it clearly made a huge impression. He even mentions specific planes like the GB Sportster. It wasn't just a passing interest. It was real passion.
And then, boom, Pearl Harbor happens. He recalls hearing the news with his buddies Dick Clark, Harry O'Neill, Fred Kroll, Clyde Bear hanging out outside the Dutchman's.
Just kids, really, and their immediate reaction.
They all wanted to enlist.
Right.
Right away. And not just enlist, they all wanted to be pilots. That shared ambition is pretty striking.
But as it turned out, Chris was the only one from that group who actually made it through flight school. Physical limitations held the others back, apparently.
Imagine that. He even had an English instructor, Doug Wakefield, who'd flown in the Battle of Britain. The stories he must have heard.
Must have been incredible. And the training itself was tough. 200 hours in the air. Primary, basic, advanced. He graduated in March 43.
So he's qualified, ready to go. But then he makes a really interesting choice about what kind of plane to fly.
Right. He ends up in single-engine advanced training down in Mariana, Florida. And this wasn't just an assignment. It was a conscious decision he made.
Yeah. And the reason why is, it's pretty heavy. He knew about the horrific casualty rates for the 8th Air Force bombers over Europe.
He quotes that statistic, doesn't he? Something like 17 planes go up, big crews, 10 men each.
And only one comes back.
Yeah.
He was, what, 19? He just didn't want the responsibility for 9 other lives on his shoulders if things went bad.
That's quite some foresight, or maybe self-awareness, for someone so young in that situation. Facing danger himself seemed preferable to being responsible for a whole crew.
It makes sense, in a way. He also mentioned something his dad told him about salutes. They're for the uniform, the rank, not the person wearing it. Maybe that reflects a bit of that perspective, too,
yeah.
Taking the personal responsibility seriously.
Could be. It shows a certain way of thinking about duty and the individual's place within the military structure.
So, fast forward to his first combat mission. The mindset is clear. The Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. They're killing Americans. The mission is to stop them. Simple as that. From his perspective then.
But later he reflects on it distantly, doesn't he? Almost finding it fortunate that being captured meant he didn't actually have to kill anyone.
Yeah, that's a really powerful reflection that comes later. But on that first mission, he's flying a plane he thought was cool, some derivative of the P-51 Mustang.
The Mustang. Yeah, that was a legendary fighter. Long range, fast, so he was in a capable machine.
He even remembers waving goodbye to his crew chief. Just a small human moment before everything changed drastically.
Because this mission, the 311th Group's first, it didn't go to plan at all.
Not even close. High-ranking officers leading, General Walls, Colonel Melton, Major Lutz. But their flight leader, Major Lutz, well, Chris says he was inexperienced. A poor pilot, basically.
And they got lost. Just lost. Shows how easily things can unravel in combat, right? Even with leadership present.
Totally. Chris actually tried to guide the major back towards base, but he got ordered back into formation. You know, rank is rank.
Oof. That must have been frustrating, knowing they were heading the wrong way.
And the result was tragic. The major ran out of gas, crashed, and Chris, he was forced to put his own plane down, ended up in a rice field.
Survived the landing, though.
Yeah, thankfully. But the plane was destroyed. And suddenly he's down in enemy territory.
So what happens then? Pure survival instinct kicks in, I imagine.
Pretty much. He actually spent the first night sleeping with his wrecked plane. Then him and the other pilot who was with him, Bo, they needed to get back.
How do you even start?
Well, first they found a river they needed to cross. So they borrowed a canoe, stole it, basically.
Resourceful, you have to give him that. But then the jungle.
Oh, yeah. Thick Burmese jungle. He tells this insane story about Bo getting stuck in quicksand.
No way. How do they manage that?
They use the lanyard from their parachute to pull him out. Just incredible improvisation under pressure. Shows how vital every piece of gear could be.
Absolutely. Just using what you have. Did they encounter anyone?
They did. Some Burmese natives, including a Boy Scout, which must have seemed like a sign of hope, right? Maybe they'd lead them towards India to safety?
You'd think so. But that hope didn't last long.
Nope. Ambushed by Japanese soldiers. Devastating. Chris says his main thought wasn't even fear. It was just, what's next? Like his brain just focused entirely on the immediate future.
That's a fascinating reaction, almost detached.
And the capture itself was brutal. Apparently, their group had done some strafing runs earlier, caused casualties, so the Japanese soldiers were not pleased.
Retaliation, basically.
Yeah. Beatings, tied up really tightly. He talks about the pain in his hands being unbearable, then just going numb.
Horrible. And Bo reacted angrily.
He did. And got hit with burning wood for it. Chris had to tell him essentially, shut up or we won't survive this. Just a raw, terrible moment. He said that first night of capture was one of the worst parts of the whole thing.
Just unimaginable. So that's the start of his POW experience. Interrogation's next.
Yep. Meets the first Japanese soldier who speaks English. They try to get info out of him, but Chris sticks to name, rank, and serial number.
Standard procedure, but hard to maintain under pressure, I'd imagine.
Extremely. They fired a rifle right next to his head, hit him with a rifle butt. He still held out.
Wow. What finally made him cooperate, even minimally?
They threatened him with a sword.
Yeah.
Held it to him. At that point, he decided, okay, maybe giving them something is the way to survive this.
Understandable. Then came solitary confinement.
Nearly 3 months of it. But interestingly, he says he didn't spend that time obsessing about escape. It's like survival was the main focus, not necessarily getting out immediately.
That's interesting. Did he notice anything else about his captors?
He mentions this weird thing, like the Japanese soldiers seem to have a certain almost awe of the Americans. Hard to square with the brutality, but it's an observation he made.
Huh. Strange contrast. And he kept something with him, didn't he? A piece of his uniform.
Yeah, from the day he was shot down, October 16th, 1943. Kept it in his pocket the whole time. Used it to carry little things he made, like a knife and fork. A tangible link to who he was.
A powerful symbol. But then there's this really crucial moment he describes, a turning point in his thinking as a POW.
Right, this is huge. He sees another prisoner, a guy named King, who's incredibly sick, can't even eat his tiny rice ration.
And Chris's first thought.
His first gut reaction, driven by starvation, was, I want his rice. It was a totally selfish, survival-based thought.
Which is brutally honest and maybe understandable in those conditions.
Exactly. But immediately after thinking it, he was horrified at himself. And that specific moment, that flash of selfishness followed by revulsion, it changed him.
How so?
It flipped a switch. From pure self-preservation to suddenly feeling real compassion, real concern for King and the other guys, he says that moment shifted his whole attitude for the rest of his time there.
Wow. That's quite a psychological insight. Finding empathy again in the absolute depths of deprivation, it shows that connection, that shared humanity, it's incredibly resilient.
It really is. So, jumping ahead, after the war, he sees an F-51, which is basically the post-war P-51 Mustang.
Mm.
And his reaction?
He wasn't hesitant to fly again.
Not at all. That passion was still there. But he does express regret that he didn't actually get back into flying professionally. Maybe lack of guidance, the war ending, the opportunity just didn't quite line up.
Yeah, the post-war world was different. Many guys faced tough transitions. And his views on fighting itself changed too, right?
Drastically. He mentioned some incident at William and Mary College afterwards that made him swear off fighting completely. He just came to see war, and maybe personal conflict too, as fundamentally stupid.
A long way from the eager young recruit.
Very long way. The homecoming itself, though,
mm-hmm.
Incredibly emotional. He describes his parents just collapsing into his arms when he finally got back.
You can only imagine. He also said something about what sustained him during captivity.
Yeah, just knowing that love was out there.
Yeah.
He was even allowed to keep a photo of his mom and sister And that small connection meant the world.
Those small things become anchors. But the adjustment back wasn't smooth, was it? He mentions William and Mary again.
No, he's very candid. Says he basically wasted 5 years there, drinking too much. It's a raw look at how deep the scars could be, even after surviving.
PTSD, readjustment issues, very common, though maybe not well understood back then. But then something changes again. He meets Connie.
Yes, Connie. He calls her the biggest powerful positive influence in his life. It sounds like she was absolutely pivotal for him.
What was it about her, do you think, based on what he says?
It seems like she offered stability, unconditional love, maybe a kind of peace he hadn't known. He mentions her deciding quite thoughtfully to marry him during a week's vacation. It suggests a real certainty and commitment from her.
A grounding force, perhaps.
Totally. He talks about how his love for her just grew stronger over the years, that it was the foundation of everything good that came after.
And he has that powerful analogy, the two powers.
Right. The first power is that sheer will to survive, the grit that got him through the prison camp. But the second power, that's different.
That's the power of love, specifically the love he shared with Connie. The power that brings peace and focus after the horrible stuff, the yuck, as he calls it, is gone.
And the way he puts it, it's incredibly moving. He says the 3 years after Connie passed away were actually harder for him than the entire time he spent in the Japanese prison camp.
Wow. That just speaks volumes about her impact, doesn't it? That connection was profound. He basically defines that second healing power as human love.
Exactly, human love. And when asked for advice for, say, a 16-year-old, it all comes back to this.
What does he say?
Don't go through life angry. Cultivate enthusiasm.
Yeah.
And above all, love one another. Simple but hard-earned wisdom.
Yeah, earned through unimaginable experience. It's really quite a distillation of his entire life's journey.
So Chris Morgan's story, the one he shares in that Military Tales episode, it's an amazing arc. From that young pilot through the absolute horror of being a POW to finding this profound peace later in life.
It really highlights the strength of that will to live, the sheer resilience people can have, but also the unexpected cruelty and chaos of war itself.
Definitely. But ultimately, what really resonates is that transformative power of love, of connection. It wasn't just about surviving the hardship. It was about what helped him truly live afterwards.
Which kind of leaves us and you listening with something to think about, doesn't it? These two powers, will and love, the drive to endure, and the connection that heals and gives meaning.
Yeah, it's a great question to reflect on. In your own life, when you face challenges, which force feels more significant? The pushing through or the connections that support and maybe redefine things.
Chris Morgan's journey certainly gives you a unique lens to look at that, wouldn't you say? How these fundamental human drivers play out in the most extreme and also the most ordinary parts of life.